Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Kuf Ayin Dalet Amud Bet, five lines from the bottom. Amar Rav Huna, Shchiv Meirash Yikdish Kol Nechasav. If you have someone who's on their deathbed who was Makdish all of their possessions, Ve'amar. And then in addition to that, he said, Mane Luploni Biyadi. This individual I owe money to, 100 zuz here, really belongs to so and so who I owe the money to, Ne'eman. He is believed in this case. Chazaka Ein Adam Osek Nunya Alekdesh. Person doesn't collude to cheat Hekdesh. So there are a number of issues with this statement of Rav Huna, the first of which is what Tosafot points out, that earlier in the Masechta, the Gemara asked the question that Shchiv Meirah Shikdish Kol Nechasav, Shchiv Meirah who consecrates all of his possessions, what is the din? If he survives that sickness, does he have a right of retraction or does not have a right of retraction? And over there, the Gemara does not come to a conclusive answer. Based on our Gemara over here, we would conclude that he does have a right of retraction, since over here he's also able to indicate that he owes the money to someone else. It shows you that since he could have retracted the gift to Hekdesh, so too he has a right to tell you who the money belongs to. Therefore, the Tosafot adjusts the case slightly and says, "V'nira the read, the Mayri dishchiv mirash yikdish kishaya bari et nechasav." That the consecration of the possessions here took place not when he was a shchiv mirah, but rather when he was a bari. V'hashta nami. Now, when he's a shchiv mirah, he says, Mane leploni biyadi ne'aman. So the only statement that was made while he was a shchiv mirah was the indication that the money belonged to so-and-so. So now, that's the issue here, which is that he's only believed as a shchiv mirah to say such a thing because he wouldn't cheat or collude against Hekdesh. If he was a bari, he would not be believed in that instance because we say that Ein Adam Choteh Velo Lo. A person doesn't sin when he gets no benefit from it. So when he's a shchiv mirah and none of that will accrue to him, and he wouldn't do anything to collude against Hekdesh and to say the money belonged to so-and-so. But if he was a bari, he was a healthy individual and went to say something like that, then we would worry about collusion, because there he would be the beneficiary of any collusion, because he's a bari. So therefore, the Tosafot says the case here is a case where he was makdishit when he was a bari, and then he retracted or says that a portion of it belongs to so-and-so when he was a shchiv mirah. Others indicate that the case here is a case where he makes the statement of the hakdashah and the statement of the necessity to pay off his other individual at the same time. And therefore, it's not considered to be a retraction, and it's not subject to the question of whether a shchiv mirah can retract or not retract, because it was said at the same time earlier on. Matkivla Rav Nachman. So Rav Nachman asks on this conclusion that we came to in the Gemara of Chi Adam Osek Nunya Al Banav. Does a person collude to cheat his children out of their Yerusha? The Rav Ushmol Damrei Tarvayu. Shchiv Meirah Shamar Madeh Deploni Biyadi. Shchiv Meirah that indicates that he owes 100 zuz to so-and-so. Amar Tznu. If he uses the verbiage that includes the word Tznu to give it to them, note name, then you do give it. Lo Amar Tznu. If he does not say the word Tznu, ain't note name, then he don't give it. Alma. Adam Masuish Lo Azbiyat Banav. We have this indication from here that there are certain instances when a person makes such a statement that the statement is not exactly true or is not really what he meant to do. So in this case, we see that Rav and Shmuel differentiate between a case where Shchiv Meirah makes a statement, including the word Tznu, where he says you give to so-and-so the money that is owed to him. Over there, we follow his instructions and we do give the money. On the other hand, if he leaves out the verb Tznu, but simply says, I owe this money to so-and-so, we don't necessarily believe him, or we do not necessarily follow through with his instructions. Alma, the Gemara concludes from this, Adam asuish lo lasbiat banav. A person might sometimes do things, not because they really owe money, but because they're trying to deflect attention, or curious onlookers, from understanding what is happening over here. And that is that this individual is passing away, and he was wealthy. That wealth now will pass to his children, and he's afraid that those that now become aware of the fact that he's wealthy might try to get some of that money, get their hands on some of that money, steal from him, similarly from him and from his children, like the Rashbam says over here, Nitkaven Shelo Yachziku Kashir. He doesn't want them to think that he is wealthy. Lohu Velo Banav. Not him, not his children, because that might lead them to either try to extract money from them, do things that would be to their detriment. So he says, falsely, that he is a debtor to certain parties in order to reduce the quote-unquote wealth that he has or the visibility of wealth that he has to other individuals. So we see that even though a person doesn't make nunya, doesn't collude to cheat Hekdesh, doesn't collude to cheat his children, Nevertheless, he might make statements that are false in order to deflect the attention from the wealth that is being passed over here or being associated with this individual or his children. So Hocha Nami, why don't we say the same thing when it comes to Hekdesh? Adam Asuish lo lasbiat atzmo, that a person doesn't want to attribute to himself a large wealth, and therefore he would quote unquote lie and say that he's a debtor to so and so in order to diminish the amount of wealth that is associated with him. So we said before that the Rishbam says this is to deflect the wealth of he himself or his children, so they are not caught for the fear of what other people could do when they have that knowledge. And then the Rabbeinu Gershom brings over here is because Notnimbo Ayin, he's afraid of an Ayin Hara, and therefore he doesn't want to have this wealth associated with himself or his children. And over here, by the case of Ekdesh, where it says Lo Lasbia Tatzmo, he says the Adam Asui Lo Lasbia Tatzmo Sheim Yakum Michol Yom, because if he survives the sickness, Shlo Yomru Alav Bnei Adam Mazal Gadol Shelosher Yesh, that this individual Ish Laploni, that this individual has a tremendous mazel, he has a lot of success. She kibates Mamon Kokach, because he was able to accumulate such wealth. So the fear here is that he might actually survive, and therefore he doesn't want this wealth associated with himself or with his children. And therefore a person, even though he will not collude on Hekdesh, and he will not collude on his children, he still may nevertheless not tell the truth about owing money in order to deflect the attention away from the fact that he has accumulated such wealth, either because of an ayin hara, because of collectors, people who will try to make false claims, will try to steal from him or of his children. And so therefore, just like by the case of the children, we do not carry through with his order that he owed money to such an individual if he doesn't specifically indicate to know that you should give it, so too by Hekdesh, we should say that the person is trying to deflect that wealth from himself, and therefore when he says he owes the money, it's because he doesn't want the wealth associated with himself and not because he really owes that money to that individual. And even though, again, he would not cheat or collude to steal from Hekdesh, here he's doing it only simply to remove that attention from himself. As the Balei Tosafot pointed out on the previous Amud, that's only in a case where the individual doesn't make a claim against him. This is where the Shechemira is voluntarily saying that he owes the money. That's when we say that maybe Shelo Lasbiat Banav, or Shelo Lasbiat Atzmo. But we don't say that if somebody comes and makes a claim against him, then if he admits to owing the money, then we're going to give the money, because that claim makes it, of course, that he's not trying to deflect the wealth, he's trying to respond to a claim that's brought against him. The Gemara in the first solution says, Kikama Rav Huna Hatam Denakit Shtara. So that case of Rav Huna is a case where the individual who's coming with the claim has a shtar to indicate the fact that the money is owed, and then the Shchiv Meira admits to the fact that he does owe the money. So there you have stronger evidence to the fact that he owes the money, and that's why the case of Hekdesh, Rav Huna says that we give the money to the individual even without the terminology of tnu being used, because there's a shtar backing up the claim in that case. It says v'chlal, from that you would conclude that Rabbi Shmuel delok nukit shtara. The case of Rabbi Shmuel are a case where he does not have a shtar. Amar tnu notnim. If he says tnu, we give it. Milval pehava. Then this is just an oral transaction. Rabbi Shmuel damrei tarvayu. Rabbi Shmuel both say, which we'll see later on today's daf, that milval peh enu gover lo mina yoshim velo mina kuchot. When it comes to a loan that is extended orally, then the creditor has no right to make a claim from the yoshim and doesn't have a claim to make from buyers, meaning that they do not have a lien on the property that is sufficiently strong to go after individuals who aren't the debtor himself. If the debtor somehow removes the assets from his possession, that can happen because he passes away and it goes to his yoshim, or it happens because he sold the assets to other parties, the creditor has no rights to go after those properties. There's no lien here because it was a milval peh. It was an oral loan. Now you're indicating that the case of Rav Huna by Hekdesh was a case of shtar. And that's why there was an obligation to pay off the creditor in that case, is because he had a shtar to back him up, implying that the case that Rav Nachman brought with Rav and Shmuel, with the case of the children, where the individual says, I owe money to so-and-so, over there, only if you said tnu do we pay it out. If he didn't say tnu, we don't pay it out. That's a case where there was no shtar. But then when he says tnu, that's the equivalent of an oral loan, and an oral loan doesn't have rights of collection from your shim. So then why should we have to follow through and give the money to this creditor when these are the Yoshim who've inherited the property? Now, the Balei Tosafot ask over here, forget about the fact that they are your shim, and this person's a debtor and a creditor, and that's a milvah al peh. What happened to the idea of matnat shchiv meira? That when a shchiv meira gives instructions, that we follow through on those instructions. And that's what he says here. Vim tomar v'had divrei shchiv meira k'tuvim u'misurim damu. So then why do you need any of this? Just simply say that that's what he said. We're going to carry through with his instructions. So over here, the Baalei Tosfot differentiate between a matana and a debt. When do we say divrei shchiv meira k'tuvim u'misurim damu? That's in a case where he's voluntarily making gifts. He's indicating that money belongs to so-and-so because he wants to gift the property to them. In that case, the Chachamim instituted Shaloti Tarif Dato, that he will not become distraught and accelerate the illness, that we carry out his words or we do what is possible so that the individual feels like whatever he's instructing will come true. On the other hand, when he's responding to a situation of a loan or money that is owed, that's a very different situation, and that's not covered by matnat shchiv meira. And so for that reason, over here, the Yoshim would not necessarily be obligated to follow through with the instructions. So, Elo Amar Rav Nachman. So Rav Nachman says that can't be the proper explanation over here. Elo Idi V'Idi Nakit Shtara. Both cases, the case of a shtar, both the case of Rav Huna, where he says he owes the money after being makdish nechasav, as well as the case of Rav Shmuel, where he says, no, that's also a case where he has a shtar. Below Kasha, so why is there a difference between the din of Rav Huna and the din of Rav and Shmuel? Because ha, the mikuyum, baha, the lo mikuyum, the difference between whether the shtar was validated in Beit Din or not. In the case of Rav Huna, the shtar was already validated in Beit Din, and therefore, once the debtor here, or the shchiv meira, admits that he owes the money, together with that shtar mikuyam, the individual has a right of collection, and as the Baalei Tosafot add over here, the advantage of having the shtar mikuyam is that over here he doesn't have to take a shvuah. He has a right, the kulu yitzrich, the gavot below shvuah. He has a right of collection without taking a shvuah. Generally, when you come to the yoshim to collect, even with a shtar, and even possibly with the shtar mikuyam, we would have thought he has to take a shvuah, because that's the only way you're allowed to collect from yoshim. What we're saying over here is that he has a shtar mikuyam, we waive the need for a shvuah, and therefore the instructions of the shchiv meira are sufficient over here for this individual to come and collect, because the shchiv meira was modeh to this debt. Even in the face of being makdish kol nechasav, we believe the shchiv meira, and therefore this individual could come and collect without any shvuah. On the other hand, in the case of Rav and Shmuel, when we're talking about the children, the yoshim that now came into possession of it, it's a case that the lo mikuyam, the shtar is not validated by Beit Din yet. So here, Amar Tnu, if the shchiv meira says, give the money, he uses the verb Tnu, he is the equivalent of validating the shtar. So here you have the debtor admitting to the validity of the shtar. That's enough, or that's the equivalent of Beit Din validating the shtar, because here the debtor admits to it. Lo amar tnu. On the other hand, if he doesn't use the verb tnu, lo kaimei l'shtarei. In that instance, he is not mikayem the shtar, he's not validating the shtar. Now we see that there is a difference between using the verb tnu and not using the word tnu. If you use the word tnu, that's the equivalent of validating the claim against you, the shtar that is being brought over here. And therefore, this individual can collect based on the statement of the debtor, who is a shchiv meira. He will not have to take a shvuah, and he will have a right to get his money back without any other claim, with simply showing up with the shtar. On the other hand, if he has a shtar and he did not use the verb tnu, then we worry about the fact that it's shalola hasbi'at banav. He admits to owing the money, not because he really owes the money, but in order to deflect the attention away from the wealth or protect his children from people knowing about the wealth, to protect against the ayin hara, all items that we mentioned before. And so only when he makes the definitive statement of tnu, which is indicative of the fact that he wants you to carry this out, he wants the money given, then do we say that that is a full admission to the shtar that is being brought over here. And therefore, there's no need for a kiyum hashtar, and the person can collect the money. And that was true in Rav Huna's case as well. When he was makdish kol nechasav, if the creditor has a shtar mikuyam, a shtar that was already validated in Beit Din, and the shchiv meira admits to the fact that he owes the money, we're going to give the money over there without any need for shvuah, and we're going to follow through with the words of the shchiv meira, despite the fact that he already was makdish kol nechasav. And similarly here, in the case of Rav and Shmuel, if he says tnu, that's equivalent of a validation of Beit Din. He'll have all the same rights the creditor in that case to take from the yoshim of the debtor. On the other hand, if he simply has a shtar, and all the shchiv meira said was that I do owe the money, Over there, we will consider the fact that he admitted it, not admission to the actual outstanding debt, but an admission that's coming to protect his children from having other people think that they have tremendous wealth. And therefore, until he gets it validated in Beit Din, that shtar will not be strong enough to collect from the Yoshim. And that's why Rabbi Shmuel said, by their din, if you don't say the word snu, then the creditor doesn't get the right just because of the admission of the Shchimera to collect from the Yoshim. Amar Rabba, Shchimera Shamar Manele Ploni Biyadid. Shchimera who says that so-and-so has this 100 zuz in my hands. Famru Yitomim Paranu. And then afterwards Yitomim, who know about this statement of their father, and it was documented, and we know that the Shchimera made such an admission. They say, Paranu, we already paid it off. Nemanim, they are believed. Tnu Manele Ploni. On the other hand, if the Shchimera says, give the money to so-and-so, Famru Yitomim Paranu, and then the Yitomim say we paid it off, ain ne'emanim. They are not believed in that case. So, building on what Rav and Shmuel said before, Rav and Shmuel said when the debtor says, just give the money, we don't necessarily believe him. And therefore, if the Yitomim come along and say, Parano, we paid it off, then they're also believed, because the indebtedness that was admitted to by the debtor wasn't so strong, because he didn't make the statement of Tnu. And therefore, when the Yitomim say we paid it off, they're believed. In the case where he said Tnu, where there was a full-fledged obligation, and they were then compelled to pay off the debtor based on the fact that he used the term tnu, then if you told me him say parano, they're not believed. The Gemara says, klapei layo, should be just the opposite. Ipcha mistabro, the opposite is more logical. Because in a case where they say tnu, there, the debtor is making a certain statement of owing the money. So in that case, Yitomim would feel compelled to carry out the word of the Shchemira, pay that individual back, and they say parano, we would believe them. But in the case where the individual just simply says that maneh leploni biyadi, and he didn't say tnu, the Yitomim are going to read that as being a wishy-washy statement. Maybe he's trying to, again, shelo lasbiat etzma, lo lasbiat banav. He's saying something that may not be true or may not be definitive in nature. So then the Yitomim are not going to pay that off. They have no reason to pay it off. They may not even be obligated to pay it off. So then when they come and say, Paranu, why should we believe them? Because they didn't feel compelled in any way to pay it off. And why is the opposite logical? Amar Tnu Maneh came into Paskavu on the Milta. Since their father made a definitive statement that they owed the money, Igalamemar Depare. Then there's a likelihood that the Yoshim actually paid it off. Maneh Leploni Biyadi came into Paskavu on the Milta. Since he does not make a definitive statement, and it's uncertain as to whether he really owes that money, there's a higher likelihood that the Yitomim didn't pay it off in that case, because they don't think that there's a real obligation over here. This is what you need to say was the statement of Rabba over here, in order for it to make sense. Now, what's interesting here, in general, and the Balei Tosfot point this out, all the Gemara had to say now was reverse that position of Rabba. If you say just the opposite, then it would have worked out. Yet the Gemara over here does not say the opposite and gives an alternate answer. And therefore, the Balei Tosafot say, the Yoda Gemara, Shamar Almaneh Leploni Biyadi Dinemanim, that the Gemara knew that that wasn't the right way, or that they knew that there was a Misora, that the opposite version of Rabba's statement, even though it might be more logical, was not necessarily true. And therefore, they had to come up with a different way to explain the version of Rabba's statement that wasn't just flipping his sides, which is Shchimera Shamar Maneh Leploni Biyadi, where Shchimera says that he has 100 zuz of so-and-so in his hand. V'amru Yitomim Chazar. Then the Yitomim say that he retracted his statement. V'amar Lanu Abba Parati. Our father then said that he paid it off. Ne'manim. They are believed that the father retracted that statement. My taima, what's the reasoning behind that? Idkure midkar. He then remembered. It came into his head. He was recalling all of his outstanding debts. He mentioned this one debt, but then later on remembered that he had already paid it off. And here you can see in the Rashbam, the reason being that that's why Hilkach lo ratza lomar adayin tnu. The fact that he didn't use the verb tnu is because of that uncertainty. He was displaying or demonstrating the uncertainty in his statement when he left out the words, it's new. And therefore, when he retracts that statement, we believe him, because the whole reason that he didn't make a definitive statement up front was because of that uncertainty. So then when he comes back to us and says that he really did pay it off, we say that the Yoshim are Ne'aman, because that seems to be a likely scenario or explanation of that which happened. On the other hand, if he says, Numan Eloploni, he says, give 100 zuz to so-and-so, Bamru Yitomim, then the Yoshim come and tell us and say, Chazar, that he reversed his position, Ramaraba Parati, that already had paid it off, Ein Nehmanim. There the Yoshim are not believed. Dimi'ita de Pare, because had he really paid it off, Lo Avamar Tznu. He would never have said the definitive statement of Tznu. Tznu means that he's thought about it, he's come to the conclusion that he owes the money, and now he wants them to pay it off. So the fact that the Yoshim now show up and say that he changed his mind and said, no, I really did pay it off already, that will not be believed over here. Now in terms of when he says Parati, over here you can see this in the Bali HaTosafot, Hainu Parati Kodem Lachen. When he says Parati, it doesn't mean that he's saying that I paid it off after the fact, but rather that I paid it off before, meaning that even before I spoke to you, I paid it off. Because what you could say over here is the case, and the Yad Ramah explains it this way, is that the individual is saying, after he admitted to the fact that he owed the money, he says, I already paid it off. Not that I already paid it off prior to my statement to you, but rather after I told you I owed the money, I paid it off. The Bali HaTosafot reject that explanation because even the Yoshim would be believed in that case. An individual comes to court and admits to the fact that he owes money. The next day they come back to court, and he says, I already paid the money off. He is believed in that instance. I mean, he's allowed to say, once the obligation devolves upon him, he's believed to say that parati, that I paid it off. Therefore, the Tosafot says it's no chiddush in the Gemara here to say that after he admits to owing the money, that he says parati, there not only would he believe, even the Yoshim would be believed in that case. And that's not a chiddush. The chiddush here in the Gemara is that he says parati kodem lechein, that he says that I remembered that I paid it off before I ever spoke to you about this admission. I had paid off the debt. It was a mistake and that I didn't remember it clearly. But that is governed by this difference into whether he uses the word tznu or not. If he uses the word tznu, that's a definitive statement. And therefore we say that he can't retract it and he can't go back and say I paid it off. Then if he leaves out the word tznu, then that's indicative already of some safek in his statement. And therefore the Yoshim come along and tell us that he was choserbo and it said that I did pay it off. They would be believed to make such a claim on his behalf, or meaning that we believe them, that he actually told them that information. So now, Bayrava, Shchiv Meirah Shehodeh Mahu. In the case of a Shchiv Meirah who admits to owing money, what is the din over here? Now, this seems to be a little bit strange, Rava's question, because then we just deal with this. Wasn't just this previous case in the Gemara, where the Shchiv Meirah admits to owing money? In one case, he says, I owe the money. In one case, he says, Tnu, give the money. But those are the types of admissions. So what is Rova asking over here? What's the din with regards to a Shchiv Meirah that is Hodeh, that admits to it? So you can see already in the Rashbam, he says that the case here is Bal Chovo To'ein Lo, that the creditor is making a claim against him. So this is different than the previous cases where he's voluntarily admitting that he owes money to so-and-so or saying that he owes money to a creditor. In our instance over here, we're speaking about a case where there is a claim outstanding against him. The creditor is making a claim. And now he's hodeh. He admits to that claim, or he admits that he owes the money. Mao, what is the din? Tzarech lomar atem eidai, or in tzarech lomar atem eidai? Does he have to say, in the course of the admission, that you who are witnessing this should be my edim? Or does he not need to say that? Tzarech shomar ktovu, or in tzarech lomar ktovu? Does he have to instruct them specifically to document that which he is saying? Or does he not have to instruct them specifically about documenting it? Now, as the Rashbam points out over here, that's because in other places, that's the protocol. If he was a bari, if he was a healthy individual, admitting to the creditor that he owed money, that would only be considered true if he does two things. One is that he says, Atem Eidai, he designates the Edim to witness the fact that he's admitting to this individual he owes the money. And number two is he can make it into a loan that has enough strength to have a lien on it or go after encumbered property if he says ktovu, write down or document the fact that I owe the money. So those are two basic requirements in any time a person admits to a loan. So what Rav is asking is those requirements, that protocol, is it necessary by a shchiv meirah? Does he have to say atem eidai? And does he have to say ktovu? The real question revolves around a much broader question, which is, does a person play games, lie, joke around at the time that he is passing away or not? And that is because that's the ultimate claim the individual has if he doesn't designate these Edim as Edim. Which is that in a case where the creditor comes to this individual and says, you owe me money, he says, yeah, I do owe you money. And they're witnesses to that. But he doesn't specifically designate them to be witnesses. Later on, when they come to court and the witnesses testify, he can simply say, Mishatani Bacha, I was joking around. I wanted to get you off my back. I didn't want to deal with you anymore, so I just said, yeah, yeah, yeah. So in that case, he's believed, and the Edim's testimony has no bearing that he admitted, because his admission could simply be a way to deflect the creditor. But if he says that Atem may die when he designates the Edim, that means that he's serious here, that he's saying, you witnessed the fact that I'm admitting to it, means I'm not playing games. I want you to know that this is the truth. So in the case of Bari, that's necessary. The question is, by Shechid Meira, what do we say? Do we say that people, while they're at Shechid Meira, might do the same thing? They might push away a creditor by simply saying, yeah, 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 I owe you? Or by the time when they're at Shechid Meira, they take things much more seriously. And so therefore, he would not make the claim of Shechid Meira, because people don't play around at the time of death. Similarly, with the case of Ktovu, does he have to say that you write it down? Or is that assumed that the individual should write it down when you're speaking about a Shechid Meira? Then he says, Bater de Bayo, after he posed the question, Oder Pashto, he answered it. Ein adam shateh b'shat mita. A person doesn't play games at the time of death. B'divrei shchimira k'chutuvim u'michusurim dami. And so therefore, over here we have an answer to both of our questions. Number one, people don't play around when there is shchimira. And so therefore he doesn't need to say, Atem may die. It's by default. If there are edim there, we assume Atem may die. That's as if he said, you are my witnesses over here. And number two is, does he have to instruct them to write it down? We say, domi. As the Bali Tosafot point out over here, this is not the way that it's used in other places in Chas. When we say in general, domi, that is that the kinyan, or the exchange that takes place, has the tokef as if there is a kinyan that is effective here, even though he never made the kinyan. His verbal instructions come along with the equivalent of a kinyan being done. And that's what we mean, kichtuvim misurim domi. Over here, we add on an additional definition, that kichtuvim misurim domi doesn't only mean that now it's an effective kinyan, even though you never made a kinyan. We're also saying it's as if he instructed the individuals to write down and document what he is saying. Now, the truth is that edim that witness a gift of a shchimira can document what the shchimira says. But that shtar that they write down is simply a recording of what was said at the time. That shtar that they give is not the equivalent of a milveh b'shtar, or doesn't grant the individuals the right to go collect as if they have a shtar and a lien. It just simply, it tells us what the Shechid Meira said. Now what we're saying is that, and this is what the Bali Tosa point out, the chiddush is over here, is that this will now have a tokef of a shtar, and therefore you could go after property that's encumbered, you could go after the yoshim, as if the individual has a lien that is generated by the shtar over here. And that's the new meaning of Ktuvim Musurim Damu, that the Gemara is saying now that the Ktuvim means as if he instructed them to write it down. Now this person is a creditor with a shtar, not simply a creditor Baal Peh. And that answers both of our questions, or the questions that were posed by Rava, which is that even though normally you need all this protocol, we, for the benefit of the Shechid Meira, waive all of these protocols and assume that number one, he's not playing around when he's speaking as a Shechid Meira, and number two, is as if he instructed to write Ketovu. And all of this is Shaloti Taref Tato, that the person should not be distraught by the fact that maybe his gift won't be carried out, or that which he's instructing won't be carried out. We facilitate all of that to ease the individual's mind at the time of their death. Okay, now we begin the next Mishnah. The Mishnah states, Hamalveh et chaveiro bishtar, a person who's a creditor, lends money to his friend with a shtar, koveh minichasim mishubadim. He has therefore generated a lien against the assets of the individual he lent to, and then he can go after encumbered property. That includes mechurim, property that was sold, yorshim, individuals who inherit the property. This lien is strong enough that the individual now has a claim against the properties of the debtor. Now, as the Rashbam points out, we've seen this many times throughout the Masechta and other Masechtot, that even if it does not include achrayut, even though it doesn't include possibly responsibility and encumbrance lien that is documented inside the shtar, nevertheless, this is granted to the individual because we say that achrayut ta'ut soferhu. If it's absent from the document, achrayut, that responsibility of the debtor and the lien extended to the creditor is as if embedded in the shtar. If it's left out, it's because the sofer made a mistake, and not because there is no right or no lien that is granted to the creditor. Ayidei Edim. On the other hand, if it is an oral loan that is witnessed by witnesses but not documented in a shtar, Govim Minichasim B'nei Chorim. In that case, you're only entitled to go after free and clear property. So the difference being the shtar and the edim changes the dynamic of the situation, in which now the person is granted a lien, whereas when it's done with a edim or done in an oral manner, that does not grant him the right or the lien to go after encumbered property. And we'll see in the Gemara why there is a difference between these two instances. Hotzi alav kedav yado shu chayav lo. If the creditor takes out a document in the handwriting of the debtor that says that he owes him money, goveh minichasim b'nei chorin, then once again he has a right to collect from free and clear property. He does not have a right to go after encumbered property, because this is not considered to be a shtar that has edim signed on it, which would give him the power to collect even from nechasim mishubadim. Areiva yutzei lachar chitum shtarot. If you have a guarantor who is signed onto a document, a credit note, but his signature comes after the signature of the edim, goveh minechasim b'nei chorin. If you go after the guarantor over here, the creditor can only go after the areiv, the guarantor's free and clear property. He can't go after his encumbered property, and that's because his guarantee is after the signature of the edim. It means it's as if there was an oral guarantee to the loan, not a written guarantee or a shtar that guarantees it, because he's written in, or the guarantee is written in after the signature of the edim. And you can see that in the Rashbam, that you need two things in order to generate the publicity that would then give you the right of lien or a right of collection from encumbered property. And that is the kevin deikatarta. You need two things. Shtar, a document, the edim, and witnesses, the mafkalei lekala. That makes it a public event. That's what we said before. In an era where there is no registry, there are no titles, but you can do a title search to see who owns the property or what liens are extended on this, what liens are already existing on this property, then we say the buyers have to be protected. And the buyers are protected by the fact that if they wouldn't know about it, or there's no way for them to know about it, then they're not going to lose out, or we're not going to allow creditors to come after them. But in the case where they should have known about it, and it is public knowledge, and that's in the case of the Rashbam notes over here, we have a shtar and a deem, then it becomes a matter of the public record, because that's something that gains publicity, then the buyers, beware. They should have known this information. They don't know this information. They cause themselves a loss. And therefore, the creditor has a right of claim, a lien, to go after not only free and clear property, but even encumbered property. Maseu ba'al ifnei Rabbi Yishmael. There was an incident that came for Rabbi Yishmael. V'amar, goveh nechasim b'nei chorim. That you only collect from free and clear property. Amar lo benanas, eino goveh lo nechasim mishubadim, v'lo nechasim b'nei chorim. What are you talking about? He doesn't have a right here, the creditor, to go after the assets of the arev, not his free and clear property, and not his encumbered property. Amalo lama. So Rabbi Shmuel says, the bananas, why? Amalo hare hakonek et achad bashuk umitzao chaveiro. There's an individual who's choking his friend in the shuk. The creditor is trying to extract money from this individual, so he's figuratively accosting him and saying, I want my money back. It's time to pay me. So the friend of the debtor shows up in the shuk and he sees that his friend's in trouble. Vamar lo, so he says to the creditor, Hanach lo, leave him alone. Vani etein lecha, and I'll pay you off. Release him. Don't bother him anymore, and I'll make sure to make the payment. Patur, he does not have to make the repayment. Shelo el emunato hilvo, because the creditor did not extend the credit over here or extend the loan based on the guarantee of the guarantor. The guarantor over here is just trying to release the individual in the predicament that he's found now. But the credit was extended without the guarantee. And that means that the creditor took that risk. And now when somebody enters the fray after the fact, that type of guarantee is not really a guarantee that encumbers him or makes a shibud. The guarantee that encumbers or obligates the guarantor is only in a case where the parties rely on him to extend the loan. He is the facilitator of the loan. That would only be true if the guarantor was there at the time the loan was extended. But guaranteeing something after the fact, that's not something that obligates you to pay. Elizu arev, shu chayav. So then where is an arev, a guarantor, obligated to pay up or be on the hook for this? Hilvo ve'anino tein lecha. Lend the money to so-and-so and that you will get paid. Chayav. Then he is chayav. Then he's obligated. Shekein alam emunato hilvo. Because in that case, the only reason that he lent the money is because of the guarantee proffered by the guarantor. And for that reason, he is now obligated. That creates a shibud on the guarantor. Amar Rabbi Shmuel, a person who wants to get wise, ya'asok v'dinei mimonot. He should get himself involved in monetary matters. She'en lecha miktoa b'torah yoter mehen. Because there's no greater skill set in the Torah. V'hen k'mayana noveya. They're like a spring that continuously comes forth. Barotzeh she'asok v'dinei mimonot. And someone who really wants to get a good basis and background and understanding d'nei mimonot, yishamei she'et Shimon ben Anas. They should learn by, or they should apprentice themselves to Shimon ben Anas. Rabbi Shmuel is obviously saying this because Ben Anas over here clarified or made it clear to Rabbi Shmuel why his psak was not necessarily right in this instance. And so therefore he says, if you really want to know or understand Dinei Mamonot, you should go to Ben Anas, who has a great understanding of Dinei Mamonot, and was able to logically explain why over here the Arev is not responsible or the Arev is not obligated to pay off his guarantee. Now, why Dinei Mamononot are different than other parts of the Torah, one of the main reasons has to do with the problem of what we call the Chumrah. That whenever you're dealing with Isser V'Heter, or you're dealing with other aspects of the Torah, if the situation is inconclusive, you can always just say that the person goes the Chumrah. We'll be Machmir in this case. We don't know what to do, so we'll be Machmir. That solution is really only a solution in other areas of the Torah. When it comes to Dinei Mamonot, that is not a solution to the problem because there are always two parties in Dinei Mamonot. So when you're machmir on one party, you're mekil on the other party. So therefore, you have to come to conclusions in the cases of Dinei Mamonot, because if you don't come to a conclusion, there's no way just to say, we'll go to Chumrah to deal with the issue. If you go to Chumrah, then you're being mekil on one, the counterparty there, and that's not fair or that's not right. And so therefore, Dinei Mamonot require a much more conclusive dealing in halacha, and that's why they are unusual in that way. The second thing is that by Isser V'Heter, there is a protocol through the Mesorah and a protocol through the words of the Torah that tell us what we should do in that case. You can somewhat apply logic to it, but in the end, it's governed by the laws of the Torah, by Isser V'Heter. By the cases of Dinei Mamonot, they are subject to a broad perspective that the Torah gives. The way that the Ramban says it al Torah in Sefer Devarim is Vasita Yashar Vatov. That one has to do that which is right and just. Doing what's right and just is a general principle that the Torah lays out. Or, from this week's Pirkei Avot, Emet, Mishpat, and Shalom, those are the requirements of an individual in the way that they act. It's also from the Shalosh de Puranato that we're going to read, that individuals have to act in a manner that is just and right. But the Torah doesn't specify the details of that, and that's really left up to you or to the Chachamim to come up with a logical way to understand and present the halachot or Dinei Mamonot, so that is the outcome. And therefore, this, in many ways, different from other areas of halacha, is really left up to the human intellect and the human ability to build a just society. And therefore, Dinei Mamonot have this unusual aspect to them, and that's what Rabbi Shmuel is saying over here, that there is no other area of the Torah, no other area of Chochmah of the Torah that is similar to Dinei Mamonot. So Omar Ula, Dvar Torah, Echad Milve Bishtar, Ve'echad Milve Alpe, Goveh Menichasim Mishubadim, person is allowed to go after encumbered property, Maitaima, Shibuda De'oraita. So over here, the Gemara is discussing the obligation of the debtor to repay. We know that the debtor has a personal obligation to repay the debts that he took out, but does his property also become a partner in his obligation to repay? The question is, are his assets also responsible for the repayment of the loan? What Ula says is that Shibuda de'oraita, that the Torah prescribes that not only is the individual encumbering himself to repay the loan, but the individual is also encumbering his assets. He gives the creditor a lien on his assets. That lien on the assets would entitle the creditor to come and not only collect from the debtor personally, but to go after the assets of the debtor. And that's whether the loan was extended through a shtar or the loan was extended orally. Because shibuda d'oraita, that the Torah says that the creditor gains a lien in the properties of the debtor, not just the debtor himself, but on his properties, and therefore they are entitled to go after those properties to collections of their debt. Now, what is the source for Shibud Doraita? The Rashbam over here says that the source is from the fact that it says in the Torah, Yotzi Elecha Havot, that when it comes to a individual who borrowed money, and now the creditor is coming to collect, it says that the debtor can bring out the avot, brings out the mashkon, or the metaltalim, that he is responsible or will add up to the amount that he has to pay off. And the Rashbam then says, v'adin l'mekarke, that's also true by karkaot, meaning that not only are his metaltalim, mishubadim, and therefore when the creditor comes, he has to bring out a mashkon, so do his karka, so do his other assets, or his real assets, encumbered to the repayment of the loan. That's the source according to the Rashbam. If you look in the Balei Tosafot, they think that that proof of the Rashbam is very precarious. The Rabbeinu Gershom, it's the first line in the Rabbeinu Gershom on this Amud, says, Shibuda shimshabdim lo nechassim shelove lemalve midoraito dichtiv eved love leish malve. He says that the love becomes in essence an eved, a slave to the malve. And we know that the property of an eved belongs to his master. So not only is the individual obligating himself in the repayment of the loan, he obligates all of his assets or his possessions in the repayment of the loan. The way that Rashi says it in Bava Metzia is that the assets of the individual, similar to what we saw in yesterday's daf, that the assets of the individual become arivim, become guarantors of the repayment of the loan. And so that the Shibud Doraita comes from the fact that the individual only lent this debtor money because not only did he have a personal guarantee that he would pay the money, but he also has assets that would back up his personal guarantee. And therefore, his assets become as if they are a revim. They are guarantors to the fact that this debtor will personally repay the loan. So one of those reasons we would say that a shibuda is doraita, velamata mamru. So then why is there a distinction in our Mishnah between a milve bishtar and a milve apeh? The way that you're describing over here, the Torah obligates the debtor, along with all of his assets, to repay the loan. And therefore, the creditor has a lien, irrespective of how the credit was extended. Why is it that the Chachamim in the Mishnah just told us that oral loans or oral credit is only collectible through free and clear property? Because we're worried about the buyers losing out. In this case, you will shut down the market for people buying property because they'll never know if there was previous loans extended on this property. And they will buy the property not knowing whether there's a creditor out there that can come and collect from them. That risk will make it that they either won't buy property or they'll pay a very de minimis amount to purchase the property. That's the case. Then even if they lends money or extends the credit in a shtar, then also because we want to protect the kuchot, then the creditor should also not be entitled to go after encumbered property. Hatam inu ninhu dafsidu anafshayu. In that case, the kuchot caused the losses to themselves because they didn't pay attention to the public knowledge that was there. As we said before, a milveh bishtar has a certain publicity surrounding it. And then in that publicity, everybody knows about it. And if the kuchot go and buy the property after that, they're taking a risk. They know the risk that's embedded in that. If they didn't check into it and didn't get that information, then they lost of their own accord. And we're not going to worry about them. If they didn't worry about it, we're not going to worry about it for them. But Rabbi Amar, Rabbi says the opposite of Ula, Dvar Torah, Echad Milveh Bishtar, Vechad Milveh Alpeh, Eino Goveh Elam Nechassim B'nei Chorin. When it comes to the Torah does not recognize the Shibuda de Oraita. That's what the Gemara says now, my time behind Rabbi's position, which is Shibuda Lab de Oraita. That the Shibuda is not included in the Torah prescription. So over here, the Rashbam claims before that Yotzi Alecha Avot, there was an obligation to take out the mashkom. He's going to say that you explain the Gemara and Bava Metzia says that that's a case where he's coming to take a mashkon after the fact. Not at the time of the extension of the loan, but rather after the fact. And therefore, it's not an indication of the shibud. The Balei Tosafot over here, again, disagree with that position of the Rashbam and say that would be al-chat kam v'kama. Because then it indicates that you have to repay with other assets besides the personal guarantee of the debtor. And therefore they reject this. The Rabbeinu Gershom, following his position before, says that maybe we'll say that the pasuk of Eved Lo Veleish Malveh is just an asmacht of Bialma. And then again, the way that Rashi explained it, that the assets are arevim, that's a nice concept, but in reality, is that really true? Do they really become arevim? And what Rabbah is saying is, no, They're not the things that guarantee. The only guarantee that the creditor has is the promise or the obligation of the debtor to repay the debts. So now, if that's the case, so then, if that's the case, there's no shibud oraita. Why is when the creditor extends the credit with a shtar, does he have a lien and he's able to go after encumbered property? In order not to close up the loan market, to shut down liquidity in the market. Because if we don't allow the creditors to go after these assets, they're just not going to extend credit because it's too risky for them. If that's the case, then by a milvah alpeh, you should say the same thing, which is that we want to keep liquidity in the market. If that's the case, then they should also have a right of a lien to go after encumbered property. Over there, there's a problem that you're right. We should do this to extend in order to facilitate liquidity in the market. The problem is there that we have to worry about the kuchot, the buyers. There's no publicity surrounding that type of loan. And therefore, you can't fault the buyers afterwards for buying property because they had no idea that this credit was extended. And therefore, we want to protect the buyers in that case. Gemara says, Umi amar rabo hochi. The rabba really say that shibuda is lav de oraita. Vama rabo. Didn't Rabba say earlier in the Masechta, Gavu karka yeshlo, Gavu ma'ot ainlo? So earlier in the Masechta, we discussed the issue of a Bechor. A Bechor has a right in the Yerusha, the things that are mukzakim, things that are assets that are already owned by the estate or by the father, but not be ra'ui, things that will come in the future, things that are on the come. So over there, the Gemara discusses what is the story with regards to an outstanding debt. If the father is a creditor, and then they have a right of collection of that debt, how do we view that debt? Do we view that debt as if collected, and therefore the b'chor has a right to get a double portion in that, because it's mukhzak? Or do we view the outstanding credit as a future asset, something that's ra'ui, something that will come into the estate, but is not owned by the estate now? And therefore, the Bechor does not get a double portion in that asset. So there, the Gemara brings down two opinions as to what the standing of an outstanding debt is vis-a-vis the estate. And it depends on how it's collected. And this is what the Gemara is quoting here from Rabba. Rabba says over there, Gavu karka, if they collected karka for repayment of the loan, yeshlo, then the Bechor gets a double portion. Seemingly, the reason is because karka, the creditor, I mean their father, had a lien on this land from the time he extended the credit. That means it's as if it was collected for him. So then if they collect the karka, they basically took back something that they were already entitled to or something they already owned. And that's why the Bechor would get a double portion. Gavu ma'ot, on the other hand, if they got repaid in cash, ain't low. That's something that was on the come. They didn't have any lien on his cash. They simply had a right of collection. And then when the debtor brought it in, that was something that's ra'oi and you wouldn't get a double portion. But what you see from that is that Rabo believes that Shibud d'oraita, that there is a Shibud over there, because otherwise, even when they collected karka, it would be ra'oi and not mukhzak, because what right did they have to that karka before that point in time? The only right they had was the fact that it was a Shibud. So what do you want to suggest over here? Let's flip the positions in Rabo and Ula over here, and that'll solve our problem, because that'll reconcile Rabo with the statement that he made earlier in the Masechta. Va'amar Ula, didn't Ula already make an explicit statement? Var Torah, Balchov, Dinei B'ziborit. That Balchov has, Mina Torah, a Din B'ziborit. Now, it's really not clear from here what the proof is, but what the Gemara ultimately is saying is that from Ula, it's clear that he thinks that Shibuda De'oraita. Now, whether that's because he says the words Dvar Torah here, that he says, Mina Torah, the Balchov, is Dinei B'ziborit, he has a right to get the lesser of properties, but that still means, Dvar Torah, he has a right of collection from the properties of the individual. So that indicates that there's a Shibud d'oraita. So maybe that's the proof over here. Or many of the Rishonim bring the Pasuk that the Rishbam brought before, which is that Yotzi Alecha Avot, that the individual brings out to you a Mashkon, and we learn from that it's Ziborit, which means that the individual who approaches and gives you the Mashkon, of course, when you ask him to go into the house and bring out a Mashkon, he's going to bring the least of his objects out. He's not going to give you the best. He's going to give you the worst of his objects. But nevertheless, what you do see is that he's still obligated to give an object to you. He's obligated to give ziborit to you. If that's the case, then we see that the metaltalim, or the possessions of the individual, are encumbered and are subject to the lien of the creditor. So if Ula says that, then clearly we can't flip their positions, because then we'll run into a stira to Ula on the other side. The Ramban suggests that the mere fact that the Malveh, when he receives the Mashkon, doesn't have a right of liquidation of the mashkon in order to get repayment of his loan shows you that the din of a bal chov is beziborit. You should just note over here that the Rashbam clearly had a different girsa in a Gemara, and over here when the Gemara says epoch, let's flip it around, our Gemara is clear that it says that they wanted to flip the positions in Rabbah and Ula. On the other hand, the way that the Rashbam has it is epoch gavu karka einlo gavu maut leishlo. He is going back to the Gemara earlier in the Masechta, and there is an alternate opinion over there. The alternate opinion is that it makes a difference whether you collect cash or collect karka. I mean, if you collect cash, the Bachor gets a double portion. If you collect karka, then he does not get a double portion. The Gemara over there explains why. When he collects cash, that's what they were supposed to collect, and therefore it's as if collected. When they collect karka, that's because he defaulted, and therefore they're taking karka. It's like a new claim, and that's ra'oi. But if you do that, then you don't have shibudet d'oraita, and Rabba's subscribing to that other position. So according to the Rashbam, that's what the Gemara was suggesting over here, epoch, to flip Rabba's position back in the Gemara earlier. But the Gemara then answers, Rabba, time the name of kamar, veloi lo svirle. Back in the Gemara on Kuf Chav Dalid, from Bet, there Rabba is not explaining his own position, but explaining the position of the Bnei Marova. I mean that the Bnei Marova, the people of Eretz Yisrael, said that the statement of Gavu Karka, then he gets a double portion. Gavu Ma'ot, he doesn't get a double portion. Rabba was coming to explain why that is, or give over their position. But he himself does not subscribe to it, because he believes that Shibuda is Lav De'oraita. Now the Gemara continues, Rabbu Shmuel, Damrei Tarvayu, Milve alpe enu gove lo mina yoshim ve lo mina lukuchot. An oral loan, which is that it's not documented in a shtar, a credit that was extended. In that case, the creditor does not have a right of a collection, not from the yoshim, not from the inheritors, ve lo mina lukuchot, and not from the buyers. My taima, what's the reason behind this? Shibuda lav de uraita. The encumbrance of the lien that is extended to the creditor is not a Torah prescribed right, and therefore he doesn't have a right of collection from either of these parties. If the assets are considered to be encumbered, whether it's Lekuchot or Yoshim, then he doesn't have a right to go after it. Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Damrei Tarvayu, Milveh Alpeh, Goveh ben min Yoshim, ben min Lekuchot. That in Milveh Alpeh, you have a right of collection both from Yoshim and from Lekuchot, because my time is Shibuda De'oraita, that Shibud is De'oraita. The lien that the creditor gets in the assets of the debtor is something that is extended to him in a Torah, and that would be irrespective of whether it's a loan b'shtar or if it's a loan b'alpet. Tosfot over here asks, according to Rav and Shmuel, who say that you don't get to collect from the kuchot or the yorshim, we know that by milvah b'shtar, they are mitakein, or they do have an institution, at least they're a banan, that one does have a right of collection from the kuchot and from the yorshim. And the only reason by the case of milvah b'alpet, we don't allow that type of collection midrabanan is for the protection of the lekuchot. But he says that's true by the lekuchot, that's not true by yorshim. So why, according to Rav and Shmuel, shouldn't you at least midrabanan have a right of collection from the yorshim? The Baal HaTos Sefot over here establish a principle, which they extend from other places in Dinei Mamononot, which is that once we have a din that has application in one aspect of a certain law, we apply it across the board. So over here, even though in terms of Yorshim, it's not relevant, the fact that Pseida de Lukuchot, nevertheless, since there is a din of Pseida de Lukuchot, which tells us that by Milvah Alpeh, we will not extend you the right to collect from the encumbered property, that will be extended also to the Yorshim because it's of a similar ilk, meaning that you're not allowed to take property that moved from the original debtor to other parties, irrespective of how it got to them, whether it's through Yerusha, whether it's through purchase. We won't allow you to go after that property, even though the reason for the takanat rabbanan not to apply over here is only relevant by the kuchot, which is pseida the kuchot, because of the kol. Nevertheless, we will apply it across the board, both to the kuchot and to the yorshim. So Gemara brings meitve, a chufer bor b'shut rabim, someone who's digging a bor b'shut rabim, which is something that he's doing without permission, and he is responsible for the nezek that happens because he's digging this bor b'shut rabim. The nafal alav shur, while he's digging or excavating out the bor, a shor falls into the bor v'harago and kills him, and it lands on him and crushes him in the bor and kills him, patur. Then the bala shor is patur because he caused his own death. This individual dug something without permission. He put a obstacle in the reshut rabim by digging this pit. The shor that fell in it, the owner of the shor is not responsible for that. The bala bor, who is in the bor now, is responsible, and he, in essence, killed himself. Lo'od, elishim, mate. Hashor, if the shor dies from the fall or the impact of the fall, Yoshei Balabor, Chayvin L'Shalem, Demei Hashor, the Balav. The inheritors of the Balabor now will have to compensate the owner of the shor for the lost shor. So over here you see something that he's obligated in Nezek. That obligation of Nezek then causes him to pass that obligation down to his children. And the Nizak, the one who was injured, has a claim not only against the individual who caused the Nezek, but even against his children. Now, the Gemara assumes two things over here, one of which is that Nezek and Halva'ah are the same thing, then an obligation in the Torah, torts in the Torah, where a person has an obligation based on the Nezek or the damage they did, turns out to be the equivalent of a loan. And the Gemara is drawing that equation of equivalence over here to say, if someone injures another party, they in essence become a debtor to that party because now they own their money for the compensation. That's number one. Number two is that the Gemara over here assumes that that obligation is a milva al peh, is an oral obligation, because there's no shtar to back it up. There is an opinion in the Gemara in Kiddushin which says that milva ktuva b'torah, milva b'shtar dami. Anything that's written in the Torah, an obligation that's written in the Torah, is the equivalent of being written in a shtar. And if that's the case, you could claim here that the obligation is not a milva al peh, but rather a milva b'shtar. Therefore, this would not be a proof, or not be a question on Rav and Shmuel. The underlying assumption of the Gemara is we have a milva al peh here, and the Yorshim are still held responsible, which is supportive of Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan, but is a question on Rav and Shmuel. But simply answer the question according to the opinion that says that a milva ktuva b'torah is k'milva b'shtar dami, and then you would avoid that whole problem. So the Rosh actually asked that question, and he notes that the Gemara in a second will say that b'sha'oma madin, once the court already gives a directorate that obligates the individual, then it becomes a milva b'shtar. But before that point, that it's not, despite the fact that we have opinions in other places that say that a milva ktuva b'torah is k'milva b'shtar dami. In the end, the Rosh says that according to those that believe that shibuda is lav d'oraita, they will clearly believe that an obligation that is imposed by the Torah will not be classified as a milva b'shtar until the Beit Din actually gives that psak. And so therefore, even though we do find opinions like that, what the Rosh says is that Rav and Shmuel, who believe that in general there's no shibuda d'oraita, will not subscribe to that opinion, and therefore you can't bring that as the answer over here. So now we have a problem for Rav and Shmuel. I'm Rav Yiloh, I'm a Rav. It's a case where he already went to court. But Marga says, what do you mean he went to court? And he was obligated to pay the Nezek. It says that the shore killed him in the boar. How could he stand trial and then be obligated to pay for the Nezek if he already died? That the shore that fell on him made him into a trefa, which means that he only has 12 months to live, so he's considered to be a walking dead person. So it's as if the shore killed him, but he's still alive in reality. He's technically dead, but in reality he's still alive, and therefore he can stand trial. Bamar Rav Nachman, didn't Rav Nachman say about this situation, or this braita, Tanitana mate Ukivaro, that he died and he was buried there? Whether that means that they buried him in the boar itself, or that the shore's impact of covering him over made it as if he was buried there. So then, there's no way that he could stand trial, because not only did he die there, he was buried there, he never left the boar. It says, Hotam Diatvi Dayane, Apuma de Bira Vechaivu. This wild case where the Dayanim were sitting on the edge of the boar, and even though he was gasping his last breaths, and he was dying in the boar, nevertheless they were able to adjudicate the case and obligate him to pay the Nezek, sitting around the boar, because he was still alive at that time. From this you would conclude, or you could extrapolate the fact that when an individual is still alive, even though he can't functionally be in Beit Din, we appoint a representative of him to stand trial, and he would be as if he was on trial or fit for trial, even though he himself can't present himself to the Beit Din. So Rav Papa now brings us the final conclusion in this machlok between Rav and Shmuel and Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish. Hilchata milval peh govem in a yorshim. When it is an oral loan, you're allowed to take from the yorshim, veino govem in a lukuchot, but you don't have a right of collection from the buyers. Govem in a yorshim, you can take collection from the yorshim, kadesh lo tino delet bifnei lovin, in order to not close down the credit in the market. If people think that they can't get their debts repaid, they're not going to lend money. So over here, we open up the possibility of collecting from the inheritors, but we did block the ability to collect from the lukuchot. That is a balanced approach, which says that the yorshim will be exposed to the repayment of the debt, but the lukuchot will not. Again, that's for the protection of the lukuchot. On the other hand, the lukuchot, you don't have a right of collection from, because it's not a public issue. And since it's not in the public sphere, we can't say to the Kuchot, you should have known. And we don't want them to lose out. We don't want to close down the market for purchases. And therefore, we say that they can't collect from the Kuchot. What comes out from here is that Rapapa gives a reason why you collect from the Yorshim, Lovin. And he also gives a reason as to why you don't collect from the Kuchot, which is the Late Kala. In doing so, it becomes unclear what Rav Papa's position is. It's not clear whether the underlying holds like Rav Shmuel that Shibud Alavdo right on, and this is the institution of the Chachamim that you do collect from the Yorshim, or he holds like Rav Yochanan Rish Lakish that Shibuda is Doraita, and the reason you don't collect from the Kuchot is because the late Lekala. Because, in this instance, he gave reasons for both sides, which makes it unclear as to what his underlying position is, and you can see that in the Baal Yatosafot, he says, Hachi Mukka Hachmilta Liba de Kuleyama, that his position here of Rav Papa goes according to everyone, Ben Laman Damar Doraita, Ben Laman Delab Doraita. Whether you hold it's Doraita or not Doraita, Rav Papa's din could be true, because he gives you a reasoning on both sides, and therefore he could fit into both Rav and Shmuel and Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Although the Baal Yatosafot bring from the Gemara and Kiddushin, which seems to indicate that Rav Papa does have a belief that Shibuda Doraita. So he says that Rav Papa's statement, which is actually generic, which is that Milval Peh, Govem Min Yorshim V'lo Min Kuchot. And then the Gemara then feeds into Rav Papa's statement what they think. And over here they read it one way, and in the Gemara in Kiddushin they read it a different way, and it's the equivalent of an Ikadamre. You have two versions of what Rav Papa's statement was, as to whether he believes Shibuda Doraita or he doesn't believe Shibuda Doraita, or he doesn't take a position in either direction. But then the Dalai Tosafot back away from that and suggests, based on the Rabbeinu Eliyahu, that the Gemara in Kiddushin, where it says Shibuda Doraita, is speaking about a din of Korban, and not in general. And he says, that's the way, V'chein Mashmalata Mitoch Perish Rabbeinu Chananel, V'chein Ikar. That's the way to explain the Gemara in Kiddushin, and that the Ikar statement of a Papa is over here. And in that statement of a Papa, he takes up a position that is reconcilable both with Rav and Shmuel and Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, because he gives the reasons for both sides of this, as to why the Yorshim do have to pay the debts and as to why the Lukuchot don't have to pay the debts. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Kufayin Vov, Omid Aleph.